You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Even if the news weren't so gloomy these days, it is February, and even in the best of times, its somber tones cause many people to suffer the midwinter blues. As an antidote to all of that, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about one of the glorious aspects of life, color, how we perceive color, and how color shapes our lives. Excuse me. Joining us now are Professor David Brainerd, the chairman of the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He studies human vision and color perception, and Andrew Elliott, a professor in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences in Psychology at the University of Rochester. He studies our responses to color, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to this week's Please Explain, and also remind listeners that you are invited to give us a call later at 212-433-9692, or you can leave comments on our show page at WNYC.org. David Brainerd, does it make sense to begin with some definitions? Is it too obvious to ask what is color?
I don't think so at all. In fact, that question has puzzled scientists and philosophers for hundreds of years, although I think we can give a reasonable description of what we mean by that.
And that is?
Well, there's sort of two, I think the key to understanding this is there's two different ways that we use the word color, and we have to distinguish them. The first thing that people often do is point at something, for example, a car, and say, that's a red car. And when we're doing that, we're describing something about the object out there in the world. When you go and measure physically what that might be, it's not redness per se, but actually what we're really referring to there is the propensity of the reflectance properties of the object or the spectrum of the light to elicit a sensation of color. And then I think that gets us to the second meaning that we say when we use color, which is, when you say I'm experiencing red or it looks red, I'm describing a mental event, a state of the mind. It's something very subjective that we experience. Because we use the same word for each color in our everyday language, they sometimes get confused. But I think if we keep straight, there are objects and lights with physical properties that produce internal mental sensations that we can kind of proceed to understand things a bit more clearly.
Because I think that one of the first questions I asked when I was a kid was, when I see red, am I seeing the same thing that the next person sees?
That's a question whenever I reveal to somebody that I study color, I often get asked. And I think it's a question we don't have great sure answers to that. It's that because the when I see color, you're really describing this internal subjective experience that's very vivid to all of us, but which is private, that you can never quite be sure. There are some reasons to think that basic aspects of color perception are common across us, which have to do with we all make the same confusions about color in a very systematic way, which we could understand perhaps better later in the show when we talk about rods and cones. We also tend to judge similarities between colors in a similar way. A standard test actually for cortical color deficits includes asking people to take a range of hues and order them according to nearest similarity, and almost everybody will do that in the same way. So there's something common there, but whether the internal thing, conscious experience that we have is the same or not is unfortunately still mysterious to us.
Andrew Elliott, have we slipped into your area of expertise? Because you have studied our responses to color.
I have. I'm not sure we're at my expertise yet. I think we do need to make sure we know what we're defining as color before we talk about response to it. I must say that in my work, I make an assumption that most people who are perceiving an object that has a hue are perceiving it in essentially the same way, chemically or physiologically. I leave some of those mysteries up to Dr. Brainerd and his colleagues.
Well, there are differences between the term color and the term pigment, aren't there? And aren't there different, even different primary colors in light and in pigments? Andrew?
There again, I would refer to the color expert. I'm more of a response to color expert.
Okay.
So I would punt to my colleague on this.
I'd be happy to speak to that briefly, actually. So there are really the two physical quantities that we have to make sense of in color are lights and light spectra. And so we talk about mixing lights. That's often called additive color mixture, because when you put two lights together, you're producing more of the stuff that's relevant, more light coming to the eye, and there are certain rules of color mixture that apply to lights. For example, if I mixed red and green lights, I would get yellow, or blue and yellow lights, I would get white. If I'm
but if you mix red and green pigments, you get brown.
You get brown. So mixing pigments or mixing paints follows different rules, and the reason is that now we're talking about objects, and the way objects, the information about object color gets to us is because light reflects off of them, and objects absorb rather than add light. They absorb light at different wavelengths. And so when you put more pigment together, you're getting more absorption and less light. And as it happens, red pigments reflect in the longer wavelengths, green reflect in slightly shorter wavelengths. You put them together, and the reflectance that's left is kind of in the middle, and there's not much of it. And so things get darker and a little more orangey, and that leads to brown. So the rules of mixing pigments in terms of their effect are different from the rules of mixing lights. And
where things happen with pigments, as a former painter, I know that if you mix red and green, you get brown. You keep on adding white, and at a certain point, something magical occurs, and instead of having tan, you have gray.
Mm-hmm.
And that only happens with pigment.
There's a second thing that goes on with pigments, which has nothing to do with our vision, but is actually physical interactions between the pigments, so that their physical properties change in ways that are a little hard to predict from what happens when you have each alone, whereas lights behave much more regularly in that way. They don't interact physically when you superimpose them.
Are the colors... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You going to say something, Andrew?
No, I'm just
okay.
Listening.
Are the colors that we think of as basic, red, blue, yellow, green, understood as basic colors in other cultures as well? The reason I ask that is I read somewhere that orange was not a part of the English language. It would either be red, yellow, or yellow, red, or some other, described in some other way, until the fruit, the naranja, was brought into England. Is that possible? Do either of you know about that?
Well, Andrew, did you want to speak to that, or?
I know a bit about that, but the bottom line is that different cultures and different languages have different understandings of color, and in each and every language that has developed, the order of color development is roughly the same, at least for the beginning colors. So initially, there's really light and dark. There's white and black, and then red is the first chromatic color to emerge in all cultures that have been studied. I have a colleague I just met at Goldsmiths College in London who's actually studying color lexical and semantic properties in the Himba, which is a tribe in the rural part of Angola. And he's finding some very, very interesting things about the development of color, perhaps beyond this show. But the bottom line is that you're indeed correct that color language is different in each culture. It's different in each language. It's developed at a different time frame in the different languages.
And so we get that cliche about the Eskimos having 100 different words for the color of snow.
Precisely. It's all based on functional properties of color. If you are an Eskimo and white is all around you, you're going to make greater differentiation in terms of what kinds of white you designate in language.
Now, Andrew, you published a study recently called Color and Psychological Functioning, the Effect of Red on Performance Attainment. Can you tell us a bit about what you found?
Sure. So we're looking more at the responses to colors that are perceived. And what we found in that particular set of studies is that when one is in an achievement situation where one's performance is going to be evaluated, if one sees red as opposed to other colors such as green, black, gray, blue, etc., one actually performs worse. And we think the reason for that is twofold. We think that there's both a learned component of the response and perhaps even provocatively a biological component. So we grow up with teachers marking our mistakes in red. We see red on stoplights, on alarms, and things of that nature. And so red, especially in contexts that are competitive or where danger is possible, tends to take on this kind of alarm or negative kind of meaning. And so we think that red in an achievement situation evokes kind of a learned response of, this is a danger situation and I need to avoid failure. And we know from many other studies that trying to avoid failure, ironically, leads to failure on performance tests.
Well, I took a psychological test some years back, and they had they had blue, green, and red, and yellow, and they asked me to choose my favorite of those colors. And I knew that by choosing one of them, I was revealing something about myself. What would I be revealing?
Well, that depends on who you ask. And if, I mean, you're asking me, and
I was afraid. I thought, oh, gee, if I pick the red, then it sounds like I'm really going to want to live too dangerously. If I pick the blue, it means I'm a bit safe. The yellow, who knows what yellow would mean?
Well, if you ask me, I don't think it's telling you much of anything about yourself or your personality. Now, if you asked it in a context-specific way, you might get more revealing information. Here's what I mean by this. We've found that red in achievement situations where one is performing leads to a negative danger association and leading to avoidant behaviors. But we've also published work where it's a paper called Romantic Red, where we've shown that males are more attracted to females when the females are wearing red.
Mm.
And so red in a romantic context means something entirely different than red in achievement context. It evokes approach behaviors and has a positive connotation. So when you're looking at those squares back in the day, the question for me is, what context are you in? What are you thinking about as you're looking at them? If it's just you're in a general kind of frame where there's no achievement or romantic kinds of context being set, I'm guessing you're just responding to the aesthetic properties of the color, and you're really not finding out anything about your personality or your internal motivation.
Well,
however, if you're in one of these other contexts and you find yourself being, say, avoiding red in an achievement context in a very strong way, I suspect that that indicates that maybe you're high in fear of failure, that kind of thing.
Hospital rooms, doctors' waiting rooms are often painted in light green. Is that because that's perceived as something that's soothing? Is blue perceived as more soothing?
Well, it is in some people's models, but in our model, it's not necessarily the case. There's got to be some strong theoretical reason for linking a color and some sort of general meaning. And with green and blue both, I think you can see context specificity. So blue can mean depression or sadness, or blue can mean calmness and tranquility, depending on what the mental context is. And the same for green as well. And so I'm one to argue for more context specificity and more nuance in the effects of color on our behavior than others who are quick to paint the color of walls a certain color based on one or two studies that show general preferences for blue or green or what have you, even if those studies aren't really scientifically done.
I've read that the human eye can distinguish between millions of different colors. Is that because there are so many different nuances, or there are so many different variations?
Well, there again, I would pass off to my colleague who knows more about the color
David?
In the brain.
Yeah. So out there in the world, when one thinks about light, there are, in fact, the physicists tell us, essentially an infinite number of different light spectra that could be entering the eye. And so the question of how many we can distinguish becomes one of sort of the precision of the sensory apparatus. And so people have very carefully in this field measured in an experiment, we, for example, could present you with one wavelength of light and ask how much do I have to change the wavelength until you can just tell the difference, and you can quantify that number. It depends a little bit on the starting wavelength, but it's a very small change, often less than a nanometer or on the order of a nanometer of light change in wavelength can be detected. And then we can also detect changes in colors because of we can detect different mixtures of lights of different wavelengths. And so this estimate that we can perceive or discriminate millions of different colors is then based on measurements of that sort. And I would say, you know, as a rough estimate, that's a good ballpark number to have in hand, extracted from these measurements, essentially the limits of our ability to discriminate colors when they're presented, say, next to each other or one right after another.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to take listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. I'd love to hear from painters as well, people who use color. I just want to tell you a quick story. I used to be a painter, and I was in an art class with somebody who was a wonderful colorist, and he told me he was colorblind. And I said, well, what is his color? And he told me the answer. And then I asked him, well, what is that color? I said, how can you be colorblind? He said, well, colorblindness doesn't prevent me from reading the names on the paint tubes. My guests are David Brainerd, the chairman of the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and Andrew Elliott, professor in the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences in Psychology at the University of Rochester. We'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC right after this. We're back with Please Explain and our guest, Andrew Elliott of the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences and Psychology at the University of Rochester, and David Brainerd, the chairman of the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Before we get to these calls, just one more thing, David, just to clarify it for me and I'm sure many confused listeners. When I look out at a scene, let's say I've gone out into Central Park and it's summertime and there's all these different flowers and the trees have different color variations of green and the sky is blue. How is that all working in my eye and in my brain?
Well, that's a great question. The first step in seeing color happens in the eye, in the retina, and the thing that's key to understand is that the light that's entering the eye, which has energy at lots of different wavelengths, as we said before, an infinite number of wavelengths, is actually coated by rod and cone photoreceptors at the back of your eye. Now, the rod photoreceptors work for us at low light levels at night, and in fact, at night we're colorblind in the sense that all we see is shades of bluish gray that go from light to dark, and that's because the rod photoreceptors are incapable of making any distinction about the wavelength of the light. The rods stop working when it gets too bright. They basically reach their maximum response and saturate, as we say, or just top out and are no longer useful for vision during daylight conditions. And then it's the cones that kick in, the cone photoreceptors, and they're named rods and cones because of differences in their anatomical shape.
But they're all working simultaneously because I'm not just seeing one color. I'm seeing all of those colors at the same time.
Right. So now when we get to the cones, unlike the rods, there are three different kinds of cones called long wavelength, middle wavelength, and short wavelength cones, or more colloquially red, green, and blue cones. And it's the fact that you've got all three kinds of cones, each sensitive to different parts of the spectrum, relatively sensitive, that allow us to differentiate between colors. So, for example, the blue sky is going to have more energy in the short wavelength, and the short wavelength sensitive cones are going to respond most to that. And it's the pattern of the responses of the, I'll call it short, medium, and long wavelength cones that let us see blue under one circumstance, whereas if you look at, say, a red flower that looks red, it's got more light reflecting at the longer wavelengths, and now the pattern will change, and the long wavelength cones will respond more, and that will cue us that it's a different spectrum of light, and we'll see it as a different color. And the key thing about this, interestingly, is that we have just three kinds of cones, and therefore human color vision is called trichromatic for the three. And it's really that fact that allows us to see a wide range of colors, say, on our computers or televisions, where just three primaries of light are being mixed. Because with just three primaries, you can mimic the effects of any light in terms of their action on the cones.
Now, so, David, you've talked about the physical response to light. Andrew, is the emotional response also a physical response?
Well, there's certainly a physical component to it. So our emotions are derived from physical properties of the brain and neurochemicals. We've shown, for example, that when people see the color red when they're taking an IQ test, the part of the brain that is indicative of avoidance motivation lights up or is activated. So that's the right prefrontal cortical area of the brain lights up. So indeed, there are physical indicators that are linked to emotion and motivational kinds of properties that we feel.
Let's take some calls. Our number again, 212-433-9692. Stephen from Metuchen, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Pleasure to be on the show. I have a question about color blindness. I can only perceive certain, I have a difficult time perceiving certain pigments of or wavelengths, I guess, of green and pink, mostly in the olive and pink ranges. And I'm curious, I guess, first of all, why it is I can perceive some colors of red and green and not others when there's only three types of cones. And I guess a follow-up question to that would be, are there any treatments that are being researched for color blindness? I'd certainly like to know some about that.
So this is David. Maybe I can speak to that.
Sure.
So the color blindness that you have is commonly called, almost surely, is what's called red-green color blindness. And that's quite well understood in terms of what's going on. And it follows naturally from this description we just had that human color vision has three classes of cones. In people who are red-green colorblind, you are missing one of the three classes. So you only have two classes of cones in your eye, and you're missing, I can't tell from your description, either the middle wavelength or green cones or the long wavelength or red cones. And our ability to distinguish greens from reds from yellows depends on comparing, as I said, the responses of those two classes of cones. And since you're missing one of them,
Why is it that I can see certain shades of red and not certain other shades?
The reason for that is that you still have got two classes of cones. You have the short wavelength cones and, let's say, the long wavelength cones, and that allows some wavelengths to be discriminated, but there'll be certain distinctions that one needs the third class to make, and since, let's say, you don't have that M cone class, you're unable to make those. So color blindness is actually a misnomer for the condition. It's called color blindness, but really, a more precise name might be color deficiency, and in fact, those of us who study color vision are fond of saying that everyone is color deficient, because in fact, if you go to, say, insects or certain birds, they have four classes of cones, and they'd regard us as, relatively speaking, colorblind.
Okay, Stephen.
That would be the ability to perceive ultraviolet lights and similar things.
That's right. So our three classes of cones do not extend in their sensitivity down to ultraviolet light. And one way that, say, insects would have better color vision than we do is they have an ultraviolet cone, an ultraviolet-sensitive cone, as do some rodents and snakes that allow them to perceive variations essentially in the color of light that extends down into the ultraviolet that we are.
But are dogs colorblind, as we've often been told?
I think dogs would also be classified as color deficient, and in fact, dog color vision would be very much like yours, Steve. The dogs typically have a short wavelength cone and a long wavelength cone and can make some color discriminations, but not as good as ours. And amongst mammals, in fact, almost all mammals are like that. They have dichromatic or two-cone-mediated color vision. It's really only the primates amongst mammals that have the trichromatic color vision that we enjoy.
So there are no animals that actually have more color perception than we do?
Well, no mammals that do, but there are the insects, the birds, some reptiles that do have, it's been established, better color vision than we do, but amongst mammals, ours is the best.
Tim from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard, thank you. I'm sitting here painting, so I thought I'd give you guys a call. But I'm not only a painter, an easel painter, but I'm also a lighting designer in the theater. And my question is this. I have noticed that one of my eyes is shifted towards the red. The other eye is shifted towards the green. So I can close one eye and I can see the color shift. But when I open both of them, hopefully I'm seeing accurate color. What would cause that?
Andrew, did you want to speak to that?
I was going to say again, that's in your expertise, so please.
So everybody's eyes contain not only the cones in the retina, but also there is filtering of the spectrum of light that occurs because of the inert pigments, and these exist in the cornea and the lens that adjust shape to focus light, and also even there are some inert pigments in the central of your eye that are thought to actually filter out short wavelengths. Now, normally, the difference in the pigmentation in the two eyes would not be large enough to cause a noticeable shift. People who go and try to measure these things can measure subtle changes. But it could be that as we age, those pigments, the lens gets denser, it causes this need for reading glasses, and that changes the filtering. Is that is progressing faster in one of your eyes, or perhaps if you're developing a cataract, it could result in color shifts that would be noticeable. When you open both eyes, the brain puts the signals from the two eyes together, essentially mixing them as long as they're not too different, and you see a unified visual world that really represents, as much as anything we see does, I suppose, the average of the two eyes. I don't know if I would say it's objectively correct, but it's certainly coherent.
Thank you for your call. I think this next call is for Andrew. Hi, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm the color psychologist at the Fashion Institute of Technology, and I'd like to thank you for doing this program today. I'm finding it quite interesting. Hope some of my students are listening. But I wanted to make a couple of comments. One is that it is so important to consider the color lexicon because we do, in fact, perceive color in terms of our conscious understanding of it. So, for instance, in more ancient forms of language that was spoken in the area today we call Scotland, there was no distinction between green and blue. So there was only one word to describe that full range of colors, which then meant that behaviorally and consciously, people were going to approach color differently. But the other comment I wanted to make was that we do know that people tend to take color in a context, and so we have this concept of arbitrary color, meaning that color's meaning changes according to context, which could be historical or temporal or cultural. And what we find, generally speaking, in Western cultures, for instance, with red, is that the reds that gravitate more toward the warmer end of the spectrum, the oranger versions of red, would be the colors that would be most likely associated with avoidant behavior or interpretations of danger or threat, while the reds that gravitate towards a bluer or cooler end of the spectrum would more often be associated with context related to love and, that whole Valentine type of thing. And this is true for any color. Greens can evoke a clean smell or a not-so-pleasant smell.
Mm. Actually, green can be associated with rotting and with the cleanest of smells. And it is interesting that you bring up smell, because a number of people have been calling it about synesthesia and physical reactions to color. Andrew, have you studied that?
I have not. I've read a bit about it, and I know it's definitely a biological phenomenon. It can be documented very rigorously at the objective level. So, people who are claiming synesthesia, they're when they're actually seeing, say, colors in numbers, you can see the actual brain processes that are linked to color perception when they see those colors. So it's not just some made-up phenomenon. It's truly going on at the biological level.
Let's take another call. Michael from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. First time, long time. I teach painting at Hunter College and Pratt Institute. And in fact, this morning I was introducing my students to the color theory of Albers and Itten. One of the hardest things I have to do with the students, I can't ever convince them that color is this imaginary psychological phenomena. They're very skeptical of that. They think that color is an immutable part of any object. So I do a really simple experiment that your listeners can do. I take a red object, and then we darken the classroom, and I shine a green light on it. And since there's no red in that spectrum for the object to reflect, it appears black. And even though my students have had chemistry and optics, they almost always guess that it's going to look purple or something like that. The strange thing is, the more I've learned about color, the more skeptical I've become of color. I've become a color atheist, and that's not a good thing for a painter to be.
You mean you don't have favorite colors?
I think I'm more interested in tonality and in the contrast of value, the range of light to dark, than I am in color as an optical force.
Well, but many painters have used color as an optical force, and one of the things they do is they put complementary colors together, and that creates some kind of a wild thing in your eye.
Right, simultaneous contrast, now, the optical buzz.
Now, David, do we understand how that works physically? If you put a red next to a green, you get some kind of a fluctuation. A visual fluctuation.
Yes. So first, I think it's great that that example you gave is an excellent one. And interestingly, when I try to teach this concept, I wheel out painters' paintings by Albers to demonstrate these phenomena, since he produced a number of very spectacular effects of the sort you're describing. There is a theory about how this works, which has to do with what happens to the signals after they leave the photoreceptors, and the notion is that these signals from say the, let's say the red, the red cones in the middle, the green cones, are combined in a differenced way. So a kind of L minus M signal that would signal redness and greenness. That produces a kind of fundamental perceptual axis. And then the idea is actually in the cells that are next after the photoreceptors, the ganglion cells of the retina that process the signals before they go on to the brain, there's actually a spatial antagonism, so that if you measure responses of a ganglion cell and you put one light in say a little central disk and you surround it with another light, the surrounding light will actually modulate the response to the center in a way that's a kind of color opponent. That is to say, a green light will enhance the responses in the red direction and vice versa. And so these contrast effects are often thought to arise from that process that's understood and measured early in the retina. There are, unfortunately, additional parts to the story that suggest that's not the whole story, but I think as a sort of first pass explanation, it accounts for many of these phenomena.
A listener, Dave in Brooklyn, says he's heard that there are a very small amount of people have a fourth cone in their eyes and can see more colors than those with three cones can. Is that true?
It's true that there are people who are now documented as having a fourth class of cones. It's almost always women, and the reason for that is because the genes that code for these pigments are on the X chromosome for the L and the M cones, and there are slight variations in those genes. And so a woman who has two X chromosomes could have as many as four genes coding for the L and the M cone properties, and that kind of provide a mixture. So that's now well established. What's less clear, and I think it's there are competing claims in the literature as to whether that fact then leads to better color vision as measured in assessing, say, your ability to see small color differences or making color confusions. There have been papers making both kinds of claims, and it's an area of quite active research these days, particularly as our understanding of the possible mechanism has improved over the past decade of work on the genetic side.
Well, are men more likely to be colorblind?
Absolutely, and it's for exactly the reason I just gave. If a man's, particularly if the mother has one of her X chromosomes that's missing the gene for, say, the M cones, and that's inherited by the male offspring with only one X chromosome, that male will be colorblind, whereas the mother might just be a carrier because her other X chromosome would code for the third pigment. So it's quite rare to have colorblindness in females, particularly red-green colorblindness, and reasonably common, perhaps 2 to 4% of men to exhibit this.
Now, we have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Daniel, who's calling from Georgia, on the line. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, you're a painter?
I'm a painter, and I'm a professor of art and art history at Emory University in Georgia, and lectured a lot about color over the years. I think I was curious to have, this sort of touches on what both of you are talking about, in terms of the use of after images by artists, sort of exploiting this effect. For instance, in Monet's paintings, you know, he claimed to see these. It's when you, say, look at blue, and after a moment you see this complementary, more or less, color hovering about it.
An orange.
Right, like an orange. Or in Grunewald, in the Isenheim altarpiece, there's this sort of alarming resurrection painting where there's a sort of orangish ball sort of hovering around this floating Christ figure, and around the edge of it, and this guy was a metallurgist as well as a painter, he has this little turquoise band. And so the perceptual effect is that this figure floats back and forth in space, as if your eye is trying to place it spatially in some sense. Sort of like when you look at a website and there's red and green, red text on a blue or green background. You know, it's very alarming, sort of jarring visually.
Well, when you look at a bright light and then you close your eyes, don't you see the complementary color?
Right, of course. You know, so, most familiar when you take a flash picture and you see.
So all of this is your eyes trying to correct something, trying to put things back in balance? Is that how you would describe it, Andrew?
Well, again, I will refer to David. I'm on the response side, not the color processing side.
So indeed, this phenomenon of after images can be quite complex, but our basic understanding of them is, just as you said, Leonard, that, and in fact, it's an adaptive process in the eye that's really designed to deal with, in fact, the huge range of variation in the color of the illumination, the intensity of the illumination in the environment. So as you go from shadow to sunlight, it turns out the visual system essentially turns down its gain on the processing of the signals, so that the bright light doesn't completely overwhelm the nervous system. That dynamic attempt to kind of keep things in balance isn't instantaneous and leads to these interesting phenomena of after images, particularly when there's a change in the color of what you're looking at. That process is out of balance across the three cone classes and produces these kinds of phenomena. They're hard to study because after images, of course, are fleeting, and you have some difficulty measuring them precisely. But just as with the color contrast, I think our best explanations of them now lie in an understanding of processes that go on in the retina.
Now, Andrew, I know you have to run, but I just want to ask you one more question. Do people tend to have a favorite color? Does the majority say that they prefer red over blue or green over yellow?
There are overall differences in color preference. From the age of about 6 on, blue is the preferred color by both males and females. It's a rather stark difference as well. Interestingly, early on, up until the age of 6, red is the favorite color of most infants and toddlers. Interestingly, however, we're even finding some context issues are going on there, in that if we show a set of one-year-old or a group of one-year-olds a couple of red and green blocks and allow them to choose between the two, they'll almost always pick the red blocks. However, if we show them a photo of an angry male before we then reveal the red and green blocks, they'll almost always grab the green blocks. So here again, we're thinking there's context involved, in that red at some very deep physiological level means hostility, means anger.
Wow.
And therefore, if we show that picture of a hostile face, they're going to avoid red. Red will now take on a negative kind of connotation, whereas if red is just shown in a positive context, it has an aesthetically pleasing appeal to the eye.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Andrew Elliott of the Department of Clinical and Social Sciences and Psychology at the University of Rochester, David Brainerd, Chairman of the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania.